Marketplace is supported by Ebsen, with workforce all-in-one printers powered by Precision Core technology designed to help businesses run at full speed. Where there's business, there's Ebsen. And by Battelle. Battelle's NeuroBridge technology is helping a paralyzed man to move again. Learn more at battelle.org.
Coming up on the program today, more fun with free money, everybody. Corporate bond sales, to be precise. The British company at the heart of American education, and our water series goes to Miami. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Financial Times, providing in-depth global comment and analysis on the latest international business, economic, and political news. The Financial Times, prepare to read beyond the expected. And by Constant Contact. With the email and online marketing tools small businesses and nonprofits need to promote their organizations. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Nuance Power PDF, designed for powerful business functionality that's scalable for the entire organization. Nuance.com/PowerPDF. PDF uncompromised.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 10th day of February today. There are three companies in this economy, count them, just three, upon which Standard & Poor's has bestowed AAA ratings, the gold standard, for their corporate bonds. ExxonMobil is one. Johnson & Johnson is the other. Microsoft is the third, and it is with that software company that we start today. Microsoft sold nearly $11 billion worth of debt yesterday. Investors fairly snatched it up. This is one of those stories that brings together a couple of threads in the economic zeitgeist, which is why we're telling you about it. In this case, monetary policy, that is interest rates, and corporate taxes. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more.
Low interest rates plus a very good credit rating means Microsoft gets cheap money, honey. But for how long? Jeremy Siegel is a finance professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
It made me think that the management there thinks that interest rates are going up and they want to lock in the low rates right now.
And investors want to buy these bonds bad, says Brian Railing. He's with the Wells Fargo Investment Institute.
Rates here in the U.S., even though they would appear to be low, are actually quite a bit higher than we find elsewhere in the world. So they look relatively attractive on a global basis.
Plus, investors use these relatively safe bonds to balance out riskier bets in their portfolio. And central banks have been buying bonds as a way to inject cash into the economy. Yep, lots of demand for Microsoft's sale.
And you might ask, they have about $90 billion of cash on their balance sheet. Why would they still want to raise cash by issuing debt?
Took the question right out of my mouth, David Choi, credit analyst at S&P.
A lot of it is because the cash that they have are overseas cash. If they want to use that cash, they would have to pay taxes on it.
Borrowing money here looks better than a bill from the IRS. So what will Microsoft do with its new billions? Marilyn Cohen is president of Envision Capital Management.
Stock repurchases, maybe some debt repayments, and of course, hopefully, increases in the dividend.
So shareholders might see some cash or a boost in stock price. The company gets cheap money, and investors get the bonds they want. Cohen says win, win, win. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There are 5.03 million open jobs in this economy right now, the highest since January 2001. The number came from the Labor Department this morning in what's called the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, the JOLTS report. How much do you love that? Hot on its heels came word from the mega supply store Home Depot, which is going to add 80,000 temporary workers for its busy spring retail season. Some unknown but likely quite small portion of that 80,000 is going to wind up getting hired on full time. But temporary employment like that is increasingly becoming permanent. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that story.
Home Depot has made it a practice of bringing on tens of thousands of temp workers each spring for periods of around 3 months. Spokesman Stephen Holmes says in this regard, Home Depot's no different than any other retailer.
Our busy season actually is in the spring. In fact, we call that our Christmas.
Still, 80,000 workers is a lot, especially when you consider that the U.S. currently has more temp workers than ever before. But economist Susan Hausman with the Upjohn Institute for Employment says we shouldn't lay blame for that at the feet of companies like Home Depot.
Seasonal hiring is very common in industries like construction, wholesale, manufacturing, etc.
Hausman points out that roughly half of Home Depot's seasonal hires end up in permanent positions, but others say there are ways to address seasonality while still providing permanent jobs with benefits.
It's also true that there's a lot of companies out there that are in seasonal industries that have a much different approach.
Roland Zello is a labor researcher at the University of Michigan. He says many seasonal industries actually find it beneficial to keep workers on.
Instead, they keep them on to do other things, other kinds of maintenance work. And then when the peak season hits, they give people a lot of overtime.
Zello says this approach actually helps companies save on training and planning while also promoting a more loyal workforce with a better quality of life. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
You remember how I said yesterday stocks were down because of worries about Greece? Any guesses about the causes of today's happy music? Well, yes, Greece is fixed. Don't you love capitalism? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Amy Scott had a story yesterday about the economics of the testing regime in the modern American education system. Today we've got an interview about the British company that has an outsized influence in that industry. The British publishing giant Pearson produces textbooks and standardized tests, students' data systems, does online classes, and a whole lot more. It's got the profits to match, as you might imagine. Stephanie Simon has a long investigative piece about Pearson in Politico today. Stephanie, good to have you with us.
Oh, great to be here, Kai. Thank you.
Pearson, a British company, starts as a construction firm 150-something years ago and now is maybe the biggest player in American education.
Right. It's a pretty remarkable story. It started, as you said, as a small family construction firm, grew to all different kinds of industries over the years, and now it calls itself the world's leading learning company, and it absolutely has a dominant presence in the U.S.
Give me a sense then. Give me a good example, and there are many in this piece that you wrote of that demonstrates its size and its scope and its influence.
So Pearson, because they control the tests and they develop the exams for so many different states, those tests have increasingly high stakes attached to them for students, for teachers, for schools. Scores on the test can help determine whether a kid moves on to the next grade, whether he earns a high school diploma. They sell evaluation software to help decide whether teachers are measuring up. And then if they're not measuring up, they sell them professional development courses online. So once you have that testing market in place, so many other businesses flow from that one perch.
And you point out examples in Huntsville, Alabama, with the K-12 school system there, the University of Florida in higher education. They don't leave many stones unturned, it seems.
Exactly. And what the story was also trying to trace was that so many of these contracts that Pearson lands are no-bid contracts, where school districts and higher education institutions contract with Pearson for a whole lot of money in many cases, and very long-term contracts in some cases, without seeking competitive bids and without looking at the many other vendors who provide those services. And to a harried public official, it sometimes seems like the easiest and most convenient way to go is just work with a company that you know, that you've heard of, and not bother to go through the competitive bid process.
One of the many amazing things in this piece was the quote from a guy at Pearson, a person, I don't know if it was a guy, who said, yeah, we are the biggest purveyor, owner of student data out there. And as we know now in this economy, data is everything.
Right. And so through its K-12 market, Pearson says that that data all belongs to the schools and it doesn't use those for commercial purposes or data mining or any of that. But what I found that was even more interesting to me was that in its work with colleges and universities, Pearson is in a position to gather huge amounts of information about these college students. And the huge bulk of that information is not protected by federal privacy law, and there's absolutely nothing in the contracts with the institutions that I looked at that requires Pearson to safeguard that information in any way.
I wonder how much of Pearson's success is, in a way, our own fault, right? This obsession we have over education and metrics and all that stuff in this country.
Right. And that's another point that the story makes is that, you know, we've just been on a constant cycle where policymakers and superintendents and principals and college professors and administrators are all looking for the next solution, the magic bullet to try to make everything better and magically lift our achievement rates. And so we've gone through a whole bunch of things, online education, the Common Core. And at every step of the way, big companies like Pearson have been there and been able to create products and services that address those needs and sell them very effectively.
Stephanie Simon, she writes on education for Politico. Stephanie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
All right, tell me if this sounds familiar, would you? You've got an ache or a pain or a bump or a lump, and what do you do? Yeah, you could go see a doctor, and that is the wiser choice, just to be completely clear here. Or you could do what a lot of us do and go straight to the internet. Google says 5% of all its searches, which is a whole lot of searches, are in some way related to health. So today it launched a new feature to help make sure that when we search health, we're getting reliable information. From the health desk at the WHYY in Philadelphia, PA, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
One of the guys behind Google's new medical information, Prem Ramaswamy, sometimes talks about valleys of disinformation we find on the web. He says he's trying to fight that.
What we've seen in the news over the last 2 weeks about measles, right? I think that we want to help people understand what is reliable scientific information versus, you know, what might be my cousin's blog somewhere.
Over the next several days, Google's unveiling a new product on key information about the 400 most searched health conditions, from measles to diabetes to frostbite. Info that includes most common symptoms and most common treatments. Dr. Dawn Mountner practices family medicine at Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia, where she says time is at a premium.
We're all trying to get to the right answer. The better the information the patient comes in with, the better our interaction is going to be. That's going to wind up improving outcomes as well as saving time and cost.
It's well known patients continue to lack critical information, whether that's symptoms for pink eye or knowing which hospitals are a threat to patient safety. MedCityNews.com publisher Chris Sepper says Google's move will likely earn loyalty from consumers.
Patients are going to look to them more, and that's going to put them in a stronger position when it comes to how do you make decisions about health.
Today, Google is dipping the tip of its toenail into the health information game. If the company moves beyond simple descriptions and into rating physicians and hospital safety and value, there's real money to be made. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up, try though you might, you cannot hold back a rising tide.
82% of these structures will no longer function. That's sobering.
Our series, Water, the High Price of Cheap, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 0.75% today, 139 points, closed at 17,868. Did the blue chips, the NASDAQ up 1.33%, 61 points, 47.87. The S&P 500 added 1.1%, 21 points, 2,068 the number. That big bump in the NASDAQ came in no small way from Apple. The tech behemoth traded up nearly 2%, becoming the first company to pass $700 billion in market value. You play that out, we might just be looking at the first trillion-dollar tech company. There was some drama in carland. Tesla clipped 0.5% today after reports of poor sales in China, just 120 cars last month. WebMD dropped 5% after that Google health search news Dan Gorenstein was just telling us about. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Burst, cloud business analytics engineered to let every business user make better data-driven decisions every moment of every day. Learn more at BIRST.com. Burst. Think fast. And by RingCentral, the cloud communication system that integrates with CRM, sales, and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. Drive business forward. RingCentral.com. And by Invest Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland, a European location offering a skilled, loyal, agile workforce at the ready. More at InvestNI.com. Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department issues its monthly statement for January. Pepsi, Tesla, and AOL are scheduled to report quarterly earnings. And some people observe Get Out Your Guitar Day. Not everyone at once, please. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. With full acknowledgement that I am being just a bit hyperbolic here, you want to solve the world's energy problems? Build a better battery. I mean, yes, sure, find a way to make renewables like wind and solar profitable, but for right now, just build a better battery. Steve Levine says it's not for lack of trying that we don't have one. His new book called Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World, is set inside the Argonne National Labs outside of Chicago, where American scientists are working on just that, the big battery. Steve, it's good to have you on.
Thanks very much, Kai.
There is, you say in this book, basically a war going on to find the next big thing in battery technology. Who are the primary players, if you will?
The primary players in the pursuit of the super battery, which is what I call it, mm-hmm. are Japan, South Korea, China, and of course the United States.
Okay, now who's winning?
Right now, Japan is winning, but that's because it's had such a huge head start. The lithium-ion battery was invented by Exxon, incidentally. It was invented by an American here. Sony commercialized it, and then Toyota commercialized the first hybrid electric car, the Prius, in 1996. So 2 decades of work on the factory floor give Japan the head start by far. However, we have a lot of firepower, so we're in the race.
And also, not to be completely shallow about this, but whoever gets it right is going to make a whole lot of money.
Oh, yeah, that's what the war is all about. But what we're looking at are industries worth tens of billions of dollars each in the first decade, meaning in the 2020s, mm-hmm. and then in the next decade, hundreds of billions of dollars.
So here we have the American government in the form of Argonne National Labs. We've got the Japanese. We've got the South Koreans. We have the Chinese. There's a scene in your book where the Chinese Minister of Technology, I think it is, or Industry comes and tours Argonne, and they're trying to get into this game. And along comes a guy by the name of Elon Musk, who says, I don't need no fancy batteries. I'm just going to build a whiz-bang car and use batteries, in essence, off the shelf.
Well, the batteries that he's using are very, very impressive, for sure. But his added value is what he can bring in design and his engineers, how they can work around what's already on the shelf.
And, of course, his cars do cost $100,000, so there's that.
They cost $100,000. Remember, the next thing that he has in store is a battle with GM. Both of them say in the year 2018, they're going to have $35,000 cars that are going to go 200 miles
wow.
on a single charge, which is the inflection point.
Yeah, because right there, I sell my minivan, right? And I buy one of these, and I never have to buy gas again, and it all works out for me.
It does. It really is. When batteries take off, they're going to take a lot of oil off the market. The same impact that you're seeing shaking up countries around the world, the price of oil going down, you're going to see that happen again in the next 5 to 8 years because of what's going to happen on the electric grid. You're going to use a lot less oil. Countries that are rogue actors in the world are going to be weaker. And so it's a very, very positive development. It's something that we're looking for over the next decade and the decades beyond.
Steve Levine is the author. It's a book called The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of a Battery to Save the World. Steve, thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Kai.
We've put more of our interview with Steve Levine online, as well as an excerpt from that book. It's all at marketplace.org. We're going to go down to South Florida now for today's installment of the series that we've been doing the past couple of days called Water, the High Price of Cheap. South Florida, which is for our purposes in this discussion Greater Miami, is a place where the idea of not having enough water seems pretty much bananas. They get about 60 inches of rain every year. The place is basically built on a swamp. The Everglades right next door spin off billions of gallons of fresh water every day. And keeping streets and homes from getting flooded again with fresh water is a huge job down there. However, climate change changes things in unexpected ways. In South Florida, rising sea levels mean ocean water won't just join fresh water in soaking the streets. It's also going to contaminate the drinking water supply. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Harold Wanless takes me out behind a car rental place by the Miami airport. He's a geology professor at the University of Miami.
When they drained the Everglades here, water levels dropped about 7 feet. And voila, you have an airport.
There's a lot going on right here. We're looking at two highways converging, planes flying overhead.
Miami High Line, the Pink Pussycat Strip Club, everything you'd want right near an airport, I guess.
And a canal running under those highways and into a little barrier here. This structure is the boundary between the salty ocean water and South Florida's fresh water supply. And the water supply, it isn't deep underground.
It goes right up to the surface. So yeah, this is our aquifer. This is our water.
One of this little dam's main jobs is actually to get rid of fresh water after heavy rains to prevent flooding. The gate opens, rainwater building up behind the dam spills out to sea. There's dams like this all over the region. For them to work, for the fresh water to spill, the seawater has to be lower than the gate, which it won't be for much longer. According to current projections, which Wanless thinks are conservative, by mid-century,
82% of these structures will no longer function. That's sobering.
Meaning when the gates are opened, seawater will flow in, and the region's drinking water goes salty. Keeping the gate closed means flooding out areas on the freshwater side. There are some ideas about how to avoid flooding. Miami Beach is spending up to $400 million on pumps to send floodwater out to sea. But there's another threat to drinking water, underground, and it's already contaminated drinking water wells in some cities here. And to see it, I went to West Palm Beach, the offices of the South Florida Water Management District. Jayantha Obisakara is a scientist there who looks at the big picture. He showed me what's under South Florida.
This is a prop that I use. So this is actually the kind of rock that you find in the aquifer in Miami-Dade.
Called porous limestone. Before I got here, I was thinking porous, like a membrane, maybe like a really thick, hard coffee filter. No.
And this is like Swiss cheese. There are a lot of openings to move through.
He's understating things. Swiss cheese doesn't have this many holes.
Yeah, like it's all opening. It's basically nothing there.
Yes.
This is what makes South Florida's problem with rising seas special.
You know, people suggest, why don't we do what the Dutch do, build a levee and stop the seawater coming? But you may stop the seawater storm surge on the surface, but the water will come underground.
That's what's happening right now. Before seawater floods the land, it's flowing into the water supply. But first, let's clear up a question. If there's really no barrier between salt water and fresh underground, why isn't all the drinking water salty already? Gravity. Salt water is heavier than fresh water. Some seawater has always moved into the limestone, but it sits under the fresh water, which floats on top. Then sea levels rise. Salt water pushes up to where that fresh water was floating, and it doesn't have to push all the way to the surface to cause problems, just to the depth where you sank your well a few decades ago.
Then those well fields will be impacted. They will go salty.
That's already happened in parts of Broward County, north of Miami. Some municipalities there now get some of their water from a county facility farther inland. The more sea levels rise, the farther inland the salt water comes, the more places get affected. Jennifer Jurado oversees Broward's long-term water planning. She shows me maps of where the salt water has already come and where it's heading.
Hallandale, Dania Beach, Davie, Fort Lauderdale. Right. It's quite
everything.
Significant.
And it's not just Broward. That's why Harold Wanless has spent almost 20 years trying to tell his neighbors across South Florida they better start planning.
If we're blindsided, we're a bunch of Okies.
As in Dust Bowl refugees. No water, no viable anything.
You know, it's going to be ugly.
For years, his warnings got a less than warm reception. Then?
It was maybe by 2005 when I would give a talk to a Rotary Club or a business group. They stopped sort of yelling obscenities at the end or during the talk and listening. They started listening.
A couple years later, people started sticking around afterwards to talk, saying, we got to do something, meaning for the community. Now he hears from people who have done something for themselves.
It's truly unbelievable, the number of people that call me or send a note saying that we had three or four properties, we just sold them and made a killing, and thank you so much.
Meaning they've gotten out while property values are still high. Wallace calls the current market real estate roulette. Looking at projections on a 30-year horizon, he says that's as long as a mortgage. He's not the only one thinking this way. I meet Rene Machado as he gets ready for a round of golf in Coral Gables. He's 75, moved here 10 years ago from New York. He thinks Coral Gables is the best place on earth. Lush, peaceful, close to downtown.
It's almost like, you know, being in New York City and living in Central Park. How cool is that?
And it's never winter.
And it's never winter.
I tell him why I'm here. Ask him if he thinks about the rising sea levels, the threat. He says, sure, all the time. And yes, he thinks about how long he should keep owning a home here.
I would evaluate every 5 years. I think after 10 years, I have to take it seriously.
So 20, 25?
Probably, if not sooner.
Wayne Pathman is a land use attorney. We meet in his 24th floor office with a panoramic view of Miami Beach and downtown. There are cranes everywhere putting up new skyscrapers. Pathman's got a hand in some of these projects, but he doesn't think everything we'll see will survive the next few decades.
There are solutions. Man has been very good about finding solutions, but I don't think we're saving everything.
He's been pushing for local officials to rethink building codes to account for where sea levels are going to be in a few decades.
This is a very developed area, high-density population, and it's coming, and yet we keep building as if it's not, and we keep living here as if it's not.
These new skyscrapers are just a small fraction of what he's talking about. South Florida's population was about 5 million in the year 2000. Now it's almost 6 and growing.
Obviously, nobody lives here if we don't have potable water.
Not even behind a seawall. In Miami, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
You're going to want to see how that gate that Harold Wanlis showed Dan up at the top of his story actually works and how it's going to stop working. Eventually, you can check out the video and the rest of our series, Water, the High Price of Cheap, at our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today about which two things. Number one, it may not be entirely appropriate for listeners of all ages, so turn down the radio for like 20 seconds. Also, number two, people do say the craziest things sometimes. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the former head of the International Monetary Fund, is on trial in France for pimping, as you might know, running sex parties in Washington, D.C. and a couple of cities in France. Anyway, at his trial yesterday, Strauss-Kahn said, and this is, believe it or not, a quote, "The prosecution gives the impression of unbridled activity. There were only 12 parties in total. That is, 4 per year over 3 years." So there you go.
Marketplace is supported by Malwarebytes, engineered to deliver a smart defense against zero-day malware, exploits, and ransomware. For business, for home. More at malwarebytes.org/marketplace. And by Robert W. Baird & Company, a financial partner keeping clients' best interests in mind since 1919. BairdWealth.com has more information.
That's it. We're done. That is Marketplace. The Dow up 0.75% today. The Nasdaq up 1.33%. The S&P 500 added 1.1% today. Caitlin Ash and Millie Jefferson are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Same bat time, same bat channel. Oh, yeah. And this is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.